Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to drive giving. QBAC doesn't just measure alumni engagement scores. It uses academic research in cognitive science and positive psychology to actually increase an alum's willingness to give. Quantitative data, such as capacity, gets a prospect into your pipeline, but qualitative data, such as impact stories, gets a prospect through your pipeline. QBAC's AI-driven system uncovers actionable insights and automatically delivers them to major gift officers for use in cultivation. Learn how to raise more money with less by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. I would also like to tell you about Responsive's training. If you're looking to align your entire team around a shared understanding of effective fundraising, let's talk about Responsive's four frameworks. If your culture doesn't feel right, before you begin any significant planning, launch a capital campaign, let's ensure that everyone is on the same page. How about inviting us to be on site with your board, leadership team, volunteers, and staff for your next planning event? If you prefer a virtual event, that'll work too. Let's get your team thinking critically and more carefully about the road ahead. Shoot me an email. I will also put some information in the show notes. Hi, Lisa. I am delighted to have you on today on the Fundraising Talent Podcast. You and I have spent a couple of minutes. We're probably going to just jump all over each other, probably jump on top of each other's words. We're probably going to get real excited today about our conversation. But before we dive into our topic, before we talk about your new book, how about you just introduce yourself to our listeners?
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for having me on the show. You do just such wonderful programs. I'm so excited to be part of it. My name is Lisa Greer. I live in Los Angeles, and I have written a book called Philanthropy Revolution, which comes out of my decade or so of being a philanthropist, having not been a philanthropist prior to that. We had a liquidation event with our family that allowed us to all of a sudden be kind of thrown into that 1% or less. And we found that the way that philanthropy is done and fundraising is done seemed really alien to us. So we kind of found our way through it, but thought this is something's very strange here. And I ended up writing a book about it and deciding that I wanted to not only let people know how donors really feel, because I found out that most fundraisers don't actually know how donors feel. And I wanted them to understand how donors feel when certain things are said to them. And I wanted to find a way to make it better for everybody. So that's what that's all about.
So Lisa, I have to ask you this. So in my seminar, one of the things I do is we'll have 25, 35 fundraisers in a room, and we start the morning with sort of asking people what their money story is. And so you sort of saying that today you're part of that 1%, but you weren't always part of that 1%. What's that? One of the questions we get people to wrestle with is what's their first money memory? So as a child, what's that first sort of memory that you have of money? And then the other question we ask, and I'm interested to hear your thoughts about this too, is sort of what do you remember about your parents when it comes to money? Like, was one frugal and one spent too much and that sort of stuff? Or what do you remember about that?
Okay, so I'll do second one first, I guess. So with my parents, it was very traditional. It was very kind of Mad Men era almost. My mom had no idea how to balance a checkbook, and if she went somewhere and they said there's no money, she would just call my dad and say, "Put money in my account." And that was sort of how women dealt with money in my household. It was not the way I used to describe it to people is I remember my father, very early memory. I was probably maybe eight or years old or something. And I remember that every day they would bring the newspaper in and they would take out, he would take out the business section and the sports section. And then the paper would, what was left of the newspaper would then go along to my mother and she would pull out the food section and the style section if there was something like that. And then the rest of the paper was sort of up for grabs, but I would grab, of course, you know, the front page and take a look at that. But they thought that was very strange because I was expected to grab, do you want to guess? Which one was I supposed to grab?
I don't know. You tell me.
It was the comics, right? The funnies.
Yes, sure.
That was appropriate. And so we were all kind of in our little box and that's what we were supposed to do. So, and money was not something you really talk about. In fact, I had an aunt in Chicago and who was, I said, something is very classy. And when we had gone to a private club or a fancy dinner or something, and she said, oh, we don't ever talk like that. We don't talk about money and we don't ever say the word classy. That's for people who aren't really what that is. And I thought, oh, okay, then I should shut my mouth about money. So that was really what that was about. I started working when I was 14 years old and really even was doing little things at home that I was selling before that. So there was never, there was never a question about not working, except that as a female, I was told that yes, you work until you find a husband. So again, back to some kind of the Mad Men thing. And then,
yes.
And you find a husband who's a doctor, lawyer, or an accountant, and you go on your merry way. And that was it. So that's how money was in my world.
Yeah. So what we're always trying to do, and this is certainly some of the message in your book, which is certainly what I want to unpack from here. But, what we're trying to get fundraisers to do in this seminar is really understand that we all have a money story and that it oftentimes reflects values and their expressions of things that are important to us. And that money is not just this sort of this economic sort of tool that we use to buy and exchange products and services, that there's actually meaning behind it. And we get these fundraisers to really sort of wrestle with that. The other exercise we do, I'm interested to hear your thoughts on this, is we get the fundraisers to actually identify for themselves what I call a trivial, a meaningful, and a significant gift. And they always wrestle with the notion. All my fundraisers in the room usually wrestle with this idea that there's such a thing as a trivial gift. And what I always sort of clarify that point with is the idea that a trivial gift oftentimes originates with a trivial decision, which is to say that the donor is not making a very meaningful decision. There's no real commitment behind it. The trivialness is not relevant of sort of the, does not reflect the size of the gift in any particular way. There's just not a lot of thought and intentionality behind it. Have you sort of seen and observed that when it comes to other donors?
Yeah. One of the donors I'm thinking about when you were saying that is my son, actually, which is probably not what you expected. But I have a donor advised fund, as I talk about in the book, for each of
us,
as well as for me. And my deal is that I put a certain amount of money, it's actually $5,000, I put into the account every year for each of the kids. And the deal is if they don't spend the money, then they don't get it refilled. And if they really want to help anybody, then they want to spend all of it because then I'll refill it. So that's how it works. And I just made that up. I found out there's one other family that does the same thing, but most people still really don't have donor advice funds for their kids, but my kids were 5 or 6 years old when I started. So my little ones. And so at the end of the first year, I said, guys, you know, we're doing this thing and you're supposed to be looking for different organizations that you want to give to. And so we had adopted a dog and my daughter said, rescued a dog. And my daughter said, oh, I want to give money to the place we got the dog from. And I said, okay, great. That's right. So yeah, we got the dog. We want to say thank you. And so she took her, we got a check, I think it was. And she went in and she gave them the money or told them she was giving them this money. And that was very exciting and great. And they did a little thing where they let her come in and pet the dog. So that was great. Because at that age, you kind of want, you want something from it. But my son said, oh, well, I want to do, we showed him a number of different places and he wanted to do the World Wildlife Federation. And why did he want to do that? Because they had a deal where whatever you gave, you got stuffed animals for that. So he just wanted to pick as many stuffed animals and that's what he gave. And so when you said trivial, I initially kind of felt kind of weird about that. Like nothing's a trivial gift, but in his case, yeah, that really wasn't a trivial gift because that really was a trivial gift because the only way that he could get those stuffed animals was by giving. So, and they didn't call it paying for the animals. They just said, if you you know, give whatever this much, you get any four of this group of 10 animals. And of course he wanted them all. So that was sort of his thing. And so I thought, well, okay, at least he's doing something and maybe he'll get the hang of it and then decide, you know, you hope after a year or two or 3 years or whatever, that they don't feel like they need to get something in return. But I would consider that a trivial gift. I think the other one that I would consider trivial is somebody who goes to an event and buys a ticket because their friend's being honored, but they really don't have any interest in the event. And they typically leave early because they're really just doing that. And they're really not a donor for that organization. And what makes me crazy is when, and what makes them crazy is when you get mailings from them forever. And there's an assumption that because you came to that event, you must be into their organization and into their mission. And they never ask you that question. They just assume it. And so until you basically say, look, guys, stop already. I just came to the event for my friend. And most fundraisers just don't want to hear it. So it's easier to assume that, oh, well, your butt was in the seat. So you're now our person. So that I would consider.
Yeah, it offends. I'm a provocative guy, and your book's a little provocative too. So I think you and I could get along really well. But the idea of a trivial gift sort of offends the fundraiser's sensibility, kind of like what you're saying. It makes them sort of shift in their seat, and they think, man, like kind of like what you said, I can't even dare think that a gift could perhaps be trivial. But what we do in this exercise is we get the fundraiser themselves to acknowledge that they've given trivial gifts in the past that were not particularly meaningful, and they had no intention of renewing them, and they did not reflect a commitment, a level of commitment and enthusiasm for the organization for which they've given this contrasting gift, what we call a meaningful gift. And the other thing that we do with the fundraisers is we encourage them to not think in terms of the actual dollar amounts. I recall I when I was a gift officer in Washington, I went up to meet with a woman in New York one time and asked, I hopped off the train, met this woman nearby at the local coffee shop, asked her for a $25,000 gift. She said yes so quickly and got me on the southbound train before the, within like 20 minutes. This was like a $25,000 gift. And they're just, you know, and for her, I don't know how meaningful that really was. And neither of us were committed to sort of having a meaningful exchange and sort of, it was just sort of this obligation on both of our parts to sort of do our part. And I just don't think that's what it's supposed to look like. And I get the impression from your book, that's not what you want fundraising to look like either.
Right. No, but also there is the piece that it is possible that this woman, and obviously I wasn't there, that she had given that money because she had done a bunch of research on you that she didn't want to really talk about. And knew exactly that she wanted to give the money. And so she just said, you know what, let me just give the money because she could be shy and she, right. Cause there isn't a, donors aren't like anything. So it's not like, you can't say any group of people are all like the same thing. So to say that, you know, to assume that donors want to have that conversation is sort of ignoring the idea that some of them are going to be shy and some of them are going to be really have short attention spans. And some of them are really want to need a full relationship. But that doesn't have anything to do with how much money, I don't think, with how much money they give. In other words, a shy person can give just as much money, if not more, than a person who, needs to have a whole relationship. And in fact, it could be the shy person could actually give way more money than the person who needs all the relationship. And then you kind of say, wait a minute, I spent all this time with this person and they only gave 5,000 and this other one gave 25 in 5 seconds. So I personally, as you saw in the book, have had multiple instances where I research an organization and I would love to have some more information later. But at the moment, I just feel like I would like to make, you know, I can see that you're in the middle of this capital campaign. Or I can see you're in the middle of this. I would like to give you this money. And I just want to send the money. And people get very, I've done it at least half a dozen times. And I usually get a very confused phone call or email, like, I don't understand, we don't know you, or we don't, you know, and it's, I just want to give you the money. That's sort of it. But as fundraisers, people believe that because you give money, then you must, that there's certain things about you. Yes, you must believe in the mission. Yeah, I think most of the time that's it, except for the party gifts that we just talked about, like the trivial ones, but they don't necessarily, to assume that somebody is, to assume anything about them, really, to assume that they are a certain kind of a person is just wrong. But the other big assumption that you mentioned earlier is the idea of giving on an ongoing basis. Uh, I had no idea, and most new donors I talk to have no idea, that giving a gift assumes that you, or having that lunch or having that conversation, assumes that this is going to be an annual thing. Nobody ever told me that a gift has any lifespan, meaning that somebody's going to come back to you for it the next year. I know it sounds sort of obvious, but I don't mind if someone comes back to me the next year. What I mind is if somebody assumes that, and you know what they say about the word assume, but they assume that I am going to be giving them a an annual gift. And that just shocked me.
So you return to that point, and I agree with you wholeheartedly. I don't know where sort of we get this, but having been on the fundraising side of things, one of the things that I know about our practices is that we generally come in from a fundraising standpoint, we generally come in at such a low level of expectation in terms of what we expect of the donor, to the point where if we don't renew that gift, it cannot be a profitable enterprise. There's no margin. And so how do we get, in your mind, because you come back to this point a number of times in the book and it caught my attention, how do we convince fundraising professionals, and more importantly, how do we convince their boards and their bosses that perhaps there's a different way to sort of get this done that is not so here's the thing. If I'm trying to get $100 out of you right now, the likelihood of me making any margin on that $100 is very unlikely. So it's embedded in the assumption, embedded in the process that I've got to renew this gift.
But then you tell me. But then you just tell me. It's the thing is, people.
So would you decline? Would you decline? I mean, it's
no,
one of
no,
the.
No. You just ask. You just say, "This is great. You know, we'd love to have you. You know, continue to be an ongoing. You could use the word an ongoing donor to our organization and." And you could do it right at the time they're giving, or you could call them a week later and say, "Hey, I just want to say thank you again. We'll be sending you some information, but we would really love to have you feel like this is part of your." What I hate is when people say we want this to be one of your fundraising priorities.
I
hate those words. That just makes it feel very offensive to me. And I don't know, people say usually one of your top fundraising priorities is, and I'm supposed
your top three, yes.
Right. One of your top three fundraising priorities. And when someone says to me, "We want that to be," I'm like, "Oh, of course you want that to be. You get paid because you're supposed to be raising all this money from me." But why don't you say, you know, is this one of your, you know, where does this fit on your list of priorities and what you really what you're into, and is this something that you'd like to know more about? Would you like to know where this money goes? Would you like to know what the impact is of this? You know, impact is a big thing now, right? And I think will continue to be. Would you like to know what the impact is of this donation and donations like that? And if the person says no, then you obviously at that point you don't assume they're an ongoing donor anymore, because that's a very direct question, and either I'm interested in knowing more about it or I'm not, or I can. And so my answer can be no, or my answer can be, you know, right now I'm really, really busy, but why don't you send me some information in 2 or 3 months? And maybe we can just talk about how the organization's going. And then we'll talk about that. And then you say, "Oh, okay, great." And then if I want to be crass about it, I'd say, "Okay, you've got them on the line then, and you can continue to work it." But if the person up front says, "This is a, I hadn't thought about the future. I just want to do this now. And I really don't have any intention of continuing to give to you," then you have that conversation up front, because what's really creepy is when people assume it and don't say it, and they just show up and say, "Okay, well, I don't understand. You didn't donate again." And I'm thinking, "Well, why are we having this conversation? I never told you I was going to donate again." And that happens more often than not.
But I'm not the first to tell you this. You've obviously done your homework, but fundraisers are taught, Lisa. I mean, you've read it. You referred to the Fundraising Effectiveness Project in your book. The Fundraising Effectiveness Project is all based on renewal rates. And yeah. So one of the things that we talk about in my seminar is the idea that of converting, how many of your donors are actually converting between this definition of what I call a trivial gift to a much more meaningful level of support, and do these relationships sort of convert with it? But instead of sort of asking those sort of perhaps qualitative questions, they're only measuring based on a quantitative data point, which is the renewal rate. And That's what 80%, I guarantee you 80% of the listeners on this, anybody who's listening to this right now, I bet 80% of them have bought hook, line, and sinker into the idea that the renewal rate is the fundamental key indicator of whether or not you're a successful fundraiser.
Well, right, of course, and absolutely. But to assume that somebody is going to be in the category of a potential renewal person and they're, you know, ongoing donor, when they had no intention to be at the beginning and they're not going to be, is a waste of time. So I would rather you find more people who are really into your mission and into your organization. So someone told me the story a long time ago when I was applying for jobs somewhere, and the guy wanted me to do one of his self-help programs or something like that. But he gave me this really great image, and I'm all about sort of images, as you'll see in the book. But you're in a room and you've got a bunch of doors, and you know, I don't know, you could think about the Matrix or whatever you want to, but there's all these different doors, and you go and you open a door and you decide, this is the door I want. This is the person I want. I want what's behind that door. And you push on the door and you hit the door and you take an axe to the door and the door is just not going to open. So freaking go to a different door. And so when somebody's not the right person and they're not, then stop pushing them. Go push somebody who is more likely to respond. So I believe more that you go to that expanding your vision of who your potential donors are is much more successful. You're much more likely to find those ongoing donors than you are by taking a donor who's on your quote list, on your like the regular permanent, you know, oh, these guys donate to other things, so I'm going to push them, and just keep pushing them, because it doesn't work. I can't imagine that there's very many stories of somebody who says upfront, this is a one-time thing. I don't want to, you know, I'm not doing this anymore. I did it at this charity auction or whatever it is and gave you some money, or I did it because 1 year, you know, my kid had a broken leg and so I'm giving to the orthopedic association, whatever it is, and then I'm done. But by somebody calling them for, you know, emailing them for, I found in some cases, 10 years of phone calls we had some organizations doing, because of that one instance, it's just like, forget it. Like after once or twice, like go on to somebody else. So that's the point. I absolutely agree that the Holy Grail is people who are going to be ongoing donors. But you also need to take that extra time to understand the person who's donating and figure out do they have the potential of being that ongoing person, and be very upfront about, we would like to develop this relationship with you, not so that it's one of your top three, but so that it's important to you, so that it becomes important to you, and that maybe you tell your friends about it at some point or whatever, but kind of state to them at the outset what you're trying to do. Obviously, after they give you the first gift, that's fine. You can do it as a follow-up meeting. But I think you make the effort, but if it's not going to work, don't keep bothering them. It's really offensive.
So why in your mind do we, the work that I've done, Lisa, has sort of been on both ends of the spectrum. So and that's the experience for a lot of us who've sort of done the work as long as I have as a fundraiser, is that you start perhaps in new acquisition work, in direct mail and special events, sort of the relatively smaller, by comparison, smaller gifts. And then you eventually work your way into the more significant, perhaps major gifts, as we oftentimes call it, and those sorts of things.
Right.
But why is it in your mind that fundraising cannot get its head wrapped around the idea that the actual size of the gift, sort of the actual dollar number, the quantitative dollar, is oftentimes not an indication of sort of what that commitment level is, about that intentionality? Because what is oftentimes what I see happening, playing out, I see this in capital campaigns all the time, that the larger gifts are necessarily reflective of that greater commitment, and that those smaller gifts are reflective of a lesser commitment. And sometimes we're talking, and I'm not talking about $50 or $100 here, I'm talking about $5,000. I have solicited gifts from fathers in K through 12 private schools where a commitment of $5,000 stretched him far more than the $100,000 gift did for the individual that was 10 or 15 years older than him.
Right. Right. So I think you're absolutely 100% right that the value of the gift doesn't tell you the commitment. So I think
yes.
The mathematical equation, value of gift, dollars do not equal sign with the line through it, commitment. It's very, 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 very true. And so, you know, a lot of times people, I know they're talking about about Jeff Bezos now, whatever, that, you know, well, he gives this huge gift. And then people say, well, it's only this percentage. You know, he makes that money in 15 minutes. So,
yes, right.
So you can't, and I think fundraisers, we want to, and I've been on the fundraising side, obviously, as well as a board member, but we want to believe that people who give us a lot of money are committed to our mission. It's just, why not, right? We don't want to believe that it's just like, yeah, okay, fine. Someone said it was a good idea. It's a small piece of what I do. I'll throw them some money, or I feel like it today. I mean, literally, it could be as small as I just feel like doing that today. The end. I'm making no long-term commitment. That's what it is. So I think a little bit of it is sort of wishful thinking. I think we want to believe that somebody who gives money is deeply, you know, has a visceral feeling about our mission and about our organization and specifically, and that they want to help us like forever. And it's wishful thinking. Sometimes it's true. And one of the examples of that I have actually of what you're saying is that volunteers, I wrote about this on my blog. If anybody wants to take a look at this, it's philanthropy 451, because I think philanthropy is on fire. But yes. What happens is volunteers are the most devoted to organizations, right? Ongoing. It's not uncommon. I was on the board of the Girl Scouts and Make-A-Wish. It's not uncommon to find people who've been part of those organizations as a volunteer. I mean, hundreds of hours a year. People have done it for 20, 30 years. So, but here's my proof. And so no one really thinks of them usually as donors. They're separate. They're a completely separate cast, if you will. I hate that, but that's what it is. You don't think of them as donors. But where I see the proof of that is that when people get what I call the surprise gifts, which are your testamentary gifts that just show up in the mail.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very, very, very often, as I'm sure you know, those come from people you don't know. They're not people who are on your regular list. And you think, well, who are they? And you very often find out, well, they volunteered for something at some point. So I don't know why we don't think, well, okay, if that's the case, maybe we should be talking to the volunteers about, you know, starting, I hate the word cultivate, but basically starting to bring them along and show them that you care about them and you really appreciate how much they care about the organization and you would like them to continue to be part of, you know, get to know you. You get to know each other. Obviously, then you can find out sometimes if there's financial resources there. But we want you to really be part of our organization. And you can tell them what the board's working on and that kind of thing, as opposed to keep them in the dark because they're, oh, just a volunteer.
Yeah. So one of the other things I picked up on in your book, and I was looking for this because it's one of the theories that I have that sort of I feel like is undermining our the professional side of this. So is this idea that fundraisers oftentimes get their professional identities tied up in their methods. And by that, I mean whether they're in direct response, whether they're event planners, grant writers, major gift officers, those sorts of things. But as I read through your book, you're not using that type of language. And what occurs to me, what seems consistent is what is the same advice I'm oftentimes giving, is this idea that donors are not thinking about their gifts in terms of whether this goes to the annual fund or whether it comes through the special event channel or the direct response channel. And they're not thinking that they're writing a grant or, you know, that's not the language that our donors speak. And yet that's how our professional identities as fundraisers sort of get wrapped up in.
Yeah, it's true. And it's funny. I especially when I was just getting going, I actually didn't know that development meant a fundraiser. I thought they would say fundraiser. And then now, of course, they use advancement and they use other types of resource development. And, you know, usually development's part of it. But the advancement thing that a lot of people are switching to, it feels like there's got to have been part of that discussion in deciding on that term had to be, well, we don't want to be as obvious that we're fundraisers, or we don't want it to be crass and look like we want money. So, okay, fine. You still do, but that's totally fine. But I always thought, when I was getting started, frankly, I don't really want to talk to the development people often. I would rather talk to somebody who actually, you know, does something else in the organization, or somebody who's in the programming, or somebody who's a senior executive or something like that.
Yes.
I had this illusion, and I believe this is the way it should be, actually, that no matter what your title is, everybody who's part of that organization has a deep feeling about the mission and about the organization. They really care about what that organization does. And so when I found out that most fundraisers were looking to leave their position within 18 months, I was just astonished because I thought, well, wait a minute, how can that be part of your sort of body and soul that you believe in this thing and this organization and the good work they do? And yet you're willing to go already, you know, one step out the door almost at the beginning because you're going to leave within 18 months. So that was very strange to me. So I just think that I should be able to go to anybody in an organization and say, hi, I would like to donate some money to you. And they will say, gee, that's awesome. Thank you so much. As opposed to, oh, well, we need to get some more information on you and we need to find out really who you are and how many people have donated. How much have you donated before? Let's check and see what your political donations have been. It's like, stop it. Just say thank you and take my money.
Lisa, they're fighting. You see, okay. And that's the same advice I was given when I was, again, this is an example of when I was in Washington, my boss, this first time I was in a major gift role, my senior director of individual giving told me, this was a large health charity. She said, Danielle said, you're going to have to learn how to go get along with the program directors on the other side of the building, because they're going to help you actually give you the content and the material. And perhaps you're going to want to take them on some of your visits and so forth, because that's who your donors are actually going to want to hear from and talk to. But the problem is that most of these development departments, advancement departments, call them what you wish, they're fighting amongst themselves for credit. Yeah. Like, who did Lisa give the gift to? Did it come through direct response? Did it come through the special event? Did it come through the form of a grant that they can't understand, that Lisa doesn't want to hear from any of that stuff? She wants to know where that money's actually going that's going to impact in our case, this was epilepsy. And so she wants to know that, you know, if her son or daughter or something is affected by this particular research grant in a positive way. But I'm not going to be able to answer those questions if I'm fighting over whether or not, you know, who in the fundraising department gets credit.
Yeah. And it also makes me crazy, right? So I think you saw that, like, we gave endowed a chair at our local hospital. It was a big thing. And we used to say at the beginning, we want to be involved in this organization. We don't want to be just a checkbook. And I'm trying not to say just checkbook anymore, because no one writes checks, or most people don't, but we don't want to be the piggy bank, right? And they said yes, but they certainly didn't mean that they were going to do that. And what makes me crazy is that when I want to know what's going on with the grant, and I want to know what's going on with this particular research project that we're involved in, we just became friends with the guy who ran it, the guy who was basically, quote, sitting in the chair. And we work with that doctor, and he tells us what's going on. And then if they want something formal, the development director people, they'll put together some special document, and sometimes I'll say, we want to present it to you. And they already know us well enough to say, no, we are not going to have a meeting about that. If you want to send me more information, great, please do that. But we would really rather just talk to the doctor and find out what's going on. But what makes me insane is that when I've been told by some organizations that, and you'll see in the book that particular hospital's really great about understanding who I am and what I want to do and what I don't want to do, and that I have an ongoing commitment, assuming that you're listening to what I do and don't want to do. Like, do not make me go to a gala, because I am not going to go. So that was, I told them that up front and said, just you can invite us, but know that we're not going to go. Please don't put pressure on us to go, because we're just not into that. So I think that when it gets really awful is when there's a simple answer, or let's say I bump into somebody who is part of the programming group, and I say, hey, how's it going? We gave this money. I want to know how you're doing. And then I get, and they talk to me a little bit, and then I get a phone call from the development director. So I literally said to them at times, why are you calling me? Well, because I heard you bumped into so-and-so. And I said, yeah, and I got the information I needed to get. And the development person doesn't know what to do with that, because and I'm sure there's some argument back at the office about, why did you do that? So I should be able to go to anybody with the organization and see what's going on with them. And nobody should be offended by that. But for some, because of this thing that you're talking about, that everybody's saying, oh no, they're mine.
Yes.
Then the development people get pissed off about it. And if they call me and they're pissed off that I did that, I'm like, wait a minute. And so in the book, there's that one story about this friend of mine where I told you two stories where I actually became friends with somebody in the sort of programming group of the organization, actually in two different organizations and completely different organizations. People don't know each other. And in both cases, they became personal friends, and we, you know, go out together. They'd stay at my house. I'd visit them. We'd go on vacations, whatever. And the development people in both cases had a fit, and said, and at one point said to one of those, these women, you are not allowed to go anywhere with Lisa again unless I'm present. And that's when it really crosses a line for me. And then it reflects badly on the organization. Then I just want to say, then maybe I don't want to give to you anymore.
Yeah, I loved the way you called them babysitters, right? Is that what you...
Yeah.
The way but Lisa, we only hold our listeners for about 40 minutes. And I've got to, because you know, when I opened up your book the other day, and folks, when I grabbed Lisa's folks sent me a copy of the book, and we knew we were going to have her on the podcast here. And when you started talking about donor advised funds, I knew you and I were on the same page. In the book that I wrote a couple of years ago, Lisa, I talked about this notion of the rise of what I called the rise of donor intent. And we in the nonprofit sector have sort of demonized and made the donor advised fund this sort of evil monster that's sort of lurking, that's going to destroy fundraising and all the potential for these fundraisers to fight over your money and da 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 da. When in fact, what I see it is a reflection of the donor safeguarding themselves from all the bullshit that you and I are basically talking about. It's basically the donor saying, hey, I want to be philanthropic. I want to be generous. I want to express my values. And I may even want to do it in a very timely way and perhaps build a relationship with an organization that I care about. But you folks are so brainless in terms of how this actually works that I'm going to use this vehicle so that I can grab the tax benefits and whatever. And I'm going to wait until I find an organization that actually has their shit together. Excuse my French, right?
Yeah, you are 100% right, and then some, because that is essentially why I wrote the book, because I kept the amount in donor advised funds, you know, $130 billion sitting there. And I thought, wait a minute, you know, this is crazy. Why are people not spending it? I thought, because it's such a crappy experience to go through.
Yes.
So why would I not? I mean, if I go through one bad experience, especially if I'm just getting going, then I just say, I don't have the time for this. And that's just why. So just put it somewhere exactly like you just said, until somebody with a brain shows up.
Right. Somewhere with a brain. I have thought that I started reading these articles a number of years ago about these donor advised funds were sort of coming down the pike and the upper middle class were starting to use them. And I thought, yeah, of course they are. That's what the super wealthy have done with private foundations for any number of years. And now other people are getting sort of smart and savvy on this. And if you don't see it, so Lisa, you're basically at the very beginning of the book and throughout sort of that underlying sort of message before we let you go, you're basically saying that sort of fundraising and philanthropy is in a lot of trouble. So can you sort of sum it up before we let you go and sort of what your concerns are? And then let's make sure we can point people in the right direction so they can get a copy of your book.
Great. Okay. Thank you. I will try and make this as brief as possible. So I what I believe, because of a lot of different things that have happened over time, is that most large institutional nonprofits and many of other size nonprofits, most of them, the money comes from, I call it 10 white men. It's usually who are older. It's usually a small group of older people, and they are typically men, not always, but
yes.
Most of the time.
Yes.
And they, when I started looking at them, I realized that the average age was somewhere around, well, let's call it the people who write checks. So it's people in their, you know, in very, very many cases in their 80s and 90s. And so when I looked at that, I thought, well, wait a minute, they're not talking to younger people because they say it's just easier. Instead of talking to young people and learning a new language of sort of younger people and people who want to know about impact, isn't it easier to just go to the guy who says, come see me once a year, I'll give you a check for $1 million and I never want to see you again until the next year, which is what kind of happens more often in that group. And I thought, if that keeps going, what's going to happen is some of those people, it's a small number of people who are keeping those organizations going. They're donating the largest amount, you know, the bulk of the money that organization lives on. And so if all of a sudden, let's say two of them die, which I don't know, they're in their 80s, 90s, perhaps one or more are going to die in the next 8 to 10 years at the most, then all of a sudden the bottom falls out of philanthropy and hundreds and thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of organizations who somehow get money from these, in some cases, these affiliated institutional kind of affiliation organizations. All of a sudden, you know, who depend on these 5-year grants and every year you're going to get whatever, $500,000. And one day it just doesn't come because that guy is gone or two of those guys are gone. then all of a sudden, you know what? They should have been spending the time on the younger people and understanding others, because they're just screwed at that point. Excuse me for using that word, but they are. And all of a sudden, not just their people, their organization is going to go away, but everybody that their organization feeds is going to go away. And I couldn't live with that. And so I said, I'm going to write a book and really try and sound the alarm and say, you know what, guys, this is what's going on. It's not okay. And something needs to change right now, because that time frame, because those guys are mostly in their 80s, is running out quickly. And then COVID happened, and I thought, oh my gosh, it's actually happened sooner. So that's what that's about.
So I'm in a small, community in central Pennsylvania, what we call a third class city here in Pennsylvania. A lot of these smaller cities that sort of sit in the shadows of Philadelphia and in Pittsburgh. And we have that list of old white men that I oftentimes refer to as sort of the lucky list. And the thing about those old white men is, yes, they're dying for one thing. But the other thing about them is that they're all sort of wising up about the fact that all these charities are dependent upon their checkbooks. And they're starting to essentially sort of speak the same language that you're speaking, because that's what we've essentially seen here in our community, is that we had this lucky list of 10 or 12, old white guys writing checks. And they're starting to say, look, I'm not going to be around forever. And my kids have moved and gone to other parts of the world. They're in Los Angeles instead of central Pennsylvania. They're not going to be writing you checks forever. And my wealth is going into an institutional, everything that you're describing. It's happening, and it's getting messy. And the other thing, the thing that sort of rattles my cage is I can't get my local organizations to think more critically about what they're doing. I can't get them to hire better talent. I can't get them to pay better wages. I can't get them to provide better training. You know, all these sorts of things that you and I are both talking about in our books. It's a mess.
Yeah, well, it has to change because the people, if anyone thinks that these older guys, that automatically their kids and their grandkids are going to give in the same way they did and give the same amount, they've got, as they say, another thing coming, because it's just not going to happen. And so the idea, and is it harder to understand this new language of younger people and do things differently? Sure. But, Steve Jobs, right? Let's think different, guys. And but at this point, it's an existential threat. And we have to think different right now. And it's not hard. There's lots of research around. There's lots of people who can explain how this thing kind of works. And gosh, golly, you can even ask a millennial, like, what are they doing? But people just don't. And so we have to make that change quickly. And that's what the book's about.
Lisa, I have really enjoyed this conversation. You and I are going to keep talking. Folks, the name of Lisa's book is Philanthropy Revolution: How to Inspire Donors, Build Relationships, and Make a Difference. Lisa, if somebody's listening to our conversation today, they want to reach out to you, perhaps continue the conversation, how might you suggest that they do that?
Well, they can actually email me. They can just go on my website. There's a link right there to my email. It's philanthropyrevolution.com. It's probably the easiest way. You can also sign up for my weekly newsletter there. Like I said, called Philanthropy 451. It's right on the page. And you can also follow me on Twitter or anywhere else. And feel free, you can, email me right off the page. Thank you.
All right, Lisa. It has certainly been a pleasure. You're always welcome back. All you've got to do is have a big idea or bold opinion about the fundraising profession. And we'll talk again.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must-read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all-too-familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.